Hey there, folks. Welcome to our podcast, Going Orbital, the show where we chat about all things space, tech, and the wild journeys that bring us there. I'm Chris, your resident space history buff who can't resist comparing modern rocket battles to centuries-old wars.
And I'm Justin, the pop culture guru with a borderline obsession for big rockets and big personalities. There's drama in the sky. I'm all over it.
And I'm flat. No, not a flat earther. Thank you for asking. It's a moniker I earned. Flat finds light after tailspin, which I earned for living the old Satan. If you don't succeed, try again, which really kind of works into what we're here to discuss today.
We're talking about how SpaceX rose from scrappy underdog to cosmic heavyweight, how Elon Musk's leadership can feel like both Sun Tzu and a chaotic Twitter feed, why reusable rockets might just rewrite the rules of spaceflight for the rest of the century. Today's book, Reentry by Eric Berger, SpaceX, Elon Musk, and the reusable rockets that launched a second space age. A cheeky startup defy expectations to become the world's leading spaceflight company. Get the untold story of the team of game changers led by a well-known billionaire who are sending NASA astronauts to space and just might carry the human race to Mars. One company dominates the modern space industry, SpaceX, founded by controversial entrepreneur Elon Musk in 2002. Now sending more payloads in orbit than the rest of the world combined, but Musk didn't do it alone. The saga of SpaceX is the story of a diverse cadre of true believers in the limitless potential of spaceflight. For the first time, Reentry relates the definitive chronicle of how this daring team was able to reinvent what it takes to reach the stars. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, covering everything from astronomy to private space to NASA policy, and the author of the book Liftoff about the rise of SpaceX. Eric has an astronomy degree from the University of Texas at Austin and a master's in journalism from the University of Missouri. He previously worked at the Houston Chronicle for 17 years, where his coverage of Hurricane Ike was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2009. A certified meteorologist, Eric founded Space City Weather and lives in Houston.
All right, everyone, so let's buckle up because we are about to blast off into this book.
In the early 2000s, NASA's kind of coasting after the space shuttle era. The big aerospace companies, Lockheed, Martin, Boeing, are comfortable with their government contracts. The rocket world isn't exactly known for speed or innovation. Enter Elon Musk, the PayPal guy, who shows up with basically says, hey, let's colonize Mars.
Right? Most people were like, excuse me? You want to do what now? It's like that moment in a war movie when the new recruit steps up and says, I'll take on the entire enemy fleet with a slingshot. And everyone else just stares.
Yeah, so he wasn't exactly your typical aerospace veteran, right? He had no experience at all. He had this mix of cocky startup bravado, big money from PayPal. So he sinks that money into funding SpaceX in 2002. And honestly, that story alone is equal parts heroic and reckless. With a whole lot of skepticism from the old space, like NASA, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, that made up United Launch.
Totally. He decides to build rockets from scratch in an old warehouse like NASA, but half the staff and a fraction of the budget. It's absolutely David and Goliath scenario. Or maybe David and Seven Goliath.
The early dismissal of SpaceX echoes classic patterns of resistance to disruptive innovation. A century earlier, air power theorist Duhay, in the command of air caution, traditional militaries, that victory smiles upon those who anticipate the changes in the character of war, not upon those who wait to adapt.
Impossible was an understatement. Falcon 1, which was their very first rocket, failed not once, not twice, but three times. Unfortunately, it wasn't the three strikes and you're out rule.
For sure. Let's talk about the fourth try in 2008. This was it. SpaceX was on the last financial legs. Elon later said he was basically out of money. If they failed again, then boom. Success. Falcon reached orbit. NASA took notice. The Air Force raised an eyebrow.
That was their Battle of Austerlitz moment. Napoleon overcame the odds, and so did SpaceX. From that day on, the aerospace giants had to admit, they're not just messing around. This might be real.
And the book Reentry details how, after that success, Musk sets his sights on bigger rockets, the Falcon 9. Because, you know, if you manage to do something small once, might as well scale it up to be 100-fold.
Yeah, right. So some leaders might have taken a breather, right? Consolidated their gains. Musk was like, nah, let's go bigger. So I think with Clausewitz, like Clausewitz said, pursue one great decisive aim with force and determination. Elon basically turned that up to 11. So this was Elon's decisive engagement, his Entscheidende, if you will.
Exactly. So in the next segment, we'll talk about the leadership style behind the unstoppable push, a style that's half Tony Stark, half drill sergeant.
So Elon Musk's leadership, how do you even categorize it? Visionary, tyrant, evil genius, benevolent dictator, all of the above.
Yeah, this is a good question, Justin. So, yes. So it depends on your perspective, of course. To end of the day, though, an unstoppable force to be reckoned with once he picked his target, right? He did, however, have a very strategic mindset, but it came with a consequence of sometimes feeling maybe a bit ruthless.
Reentry shows that Elon's approach is a triple threat. Insane ambition, relentless work ethic, and an iron fist style of management. If you're on his team, he expects you to be on call 24/7. People at SpaceX basically lived in the factory at all times.
This reminds me of that antidote. If you complain about a 90-hour work week, Elon would basically shrug and suggest you just need to go faster. Let's be real, that's no standard HR approach.
No, definitely not. But in fairness, this is rocket science. Speed and iteration were key to making breakthroughs. Like how a general might keep pushing the front lines before the enemy can regroup. Musk believed if you tried something quickly and it blew up, that was more valuable than never trying at all.
Yeah, he basically turned rocket engineering into fail, fix, fail again. Just do it at lightning speed. Except the stakes are bigger. You're dealing with actual rocket explosions and not just a crashed cash app, right? And if in that explosion was not just your rocket, but possibly millions of dollars of payload from companies whose success virtually depended on it getting to orbit.
Sometimes the old school aerospace heads found that nuts. They're used to methodical years-long design cycles. NASA decades of best practices. Musk was like, we can do a test flight next month.
He definitely got pushback. Some folks left because the burnout was insane, but others thrived. This is where the Gen Z style meets traditional approach. Ironically, because there's an entrepreneurial hustle, but also a throwback to older days when the boss said jump and you said how high.
Man, that sounds familiar. Hey, in reentry, Eric Berger, he points out many employees admired Musk's determinations. He was on the factory floor with them at 2 a.m. You know, they're doing almost anything to meet his deadlines, partly because they believed in that vision too. So when it came down to it, you know, that was Musk's superpower with his team. He could drive them to the limit and then beyond.
That vision, a multiplanetary species, launch people to Mars, reusing rockets like their passenger jets, it's the stuff of epic sci-fi. It's also the reason half of them put up with the demanding environment. How often do you get to literally change humanity's future, right?
Then there's unpredictability. One day Musk is absolutely praising your idea. The next day you might get fired if he thinks you're standing in the way. It's reminiscent of a certain short French general who'd reward brilliance one week and banish you if you displeased him the next.
And that's definitely the vibe. But the bottom line, for all the drama, it worked. By 2010, the Falcon 9 was launching, eventually carrying cargo for NASA and dethroning the old guard. So love him or hate him, that leadership style forced a paradigm shift.
Yeah, paradigm shift. That's the right term. So speaking of a paradigm shift, let's pivot to the next big piece of the discussion, the reusability concept. Because that, my friends, this is where Musk took the entire aerospace industry and said, you know, welcome to my master class quotes. This is the equivalent of Kitty Hawk, right? This is the first flight. But instead of it taking 70 years to get to the moon, SpaceX would do it in about half a decade and return the rocket to.
So for decades, the standard for rockets was launch it, watch the boosters fall into the ocean, and then build a new one. Musk basically said, "That's insane. What if we land the rocket and use it again?"
A lot of bigwigs in the industry laughed. They said, "Dude, that's physically possible, maybe, in theory, but practically impossible. Or it'd be so expensive that it wouldn't matter."
Yeah, so what does Musk retort with? Well, okay, so if we build a 747 and we tossed one away after every time it flies, we have to build another 747. Airline tickets would cost millions. So why not apply the same logic to rockets? Burger hits and reentry, you know, how that single idea, true reuse, that's the holy grail.
Right. They started with these weird test vehicles like the Grasshopper, short hop flights in Texas. It looked almost silly, a rocket going up a few hundred feet, then gingerly coming back down.
People forget how many times those test flights went kaboom. The footage is both hilarious and terrifying. The rocket tries to land, tilts too far, and wham, Explosion City. Every time SpaceX steadied the debris, like it was some valuable puzzle.
So yeah, you know, spoke to you a little bit earlier, but so the approach was essentially test, fail, adapt. Speed is everything. They decided they'd rather blow up a rocket and test rather than let theoretical fear block them from progress.
Eventually, in late 2015, they nailed the landing back at Cape Canaveral. That was a huge day. I remember seeing that rocket come down so gracefully. It was beautiful, huge. It was like seeing a basketball do a perfect swish from half court.
It changed the narrative instantly. Suddenly, everyone realized, like, oh, it's not impossible. People went from mocking to, oh no, SpaceX just raised the bar on us.
Yeah, then came the landings of the famous drone ships, of course, named Of Course I Still Love You, and Just Read the Instructions, right? So this is just them in SpaceX plastering their humor in memes all over these boats. And that brand of humor, plus insane feats, yeah, the brand, you could exactly call that. That's Musk's brand.
Those landings revolutionized rocket economics. Eventually, they flew the same booster over and over. We can see reentry, how it slashed launch cost, ramped up flight frequency, and basically gave SpaceX a major edge.
It's good to outmaneuvering your enemy in warfare. The rest of the field is still shipping and fresh troops, your rockets each time, while you keep reusing your veterans.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, Justin. And then the big question. Why stop at a Falcon 9? So enter Starship, Musk's giant steel rocket. That's basically the next step. 100% reusable, bigger than anything ever built, greater payloads, greater profits.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll dig deeper into Starship in the coming segments. Let's first talk about the effect of reusability had on the rest of the industry. Because, oh boy, the old guard was not thrilled.
So you've got Boeing, Lockheed, and European Ariane Group. These folks have done rockets for decades, often on a cost-plus contract with guaranteed profit margins. Then SpaceX shows up with cheaper, faster, partially reusable rockets.
Now you can only imagine how that went over. Suddenly, the big players scramble. Europe invests in Erlang 6, trying to cut costs. United Launch Alliance tries to develop the Vulcan to keep pace. Everyone's asking, how do we catch up with SpaceX?
Yeah, as I read through Berger the first time, it's like watching the old generals realize they're dealing with a new type of warfare. And immediately, it was like the French in World War I meeting German machine gun nests with infantry charges in Alsace, you know, just getting mowed down. The old way doesn't work. So either what do? You either adapt. You adapt fast, or you be defeated.
United Launch Alliance used to launch all of America's military satellites on their Atlas and Delta rockets with basically no competition. Then SpaceX came along, sued the Air Force for the chance to compete, and spoiler alert, SpaceX started winning big contracts.
Oh, yeah. And reentry mentions how political it got. Senator Richard Shelby from Alabama home to a big chunk of the rocket industry, was not SpaceX's biggest fan. Let's say he used terms like rocket hobbyists.
SpaceX responded with successful flights and cheaper prices. Elon's approach was, we'll let the results speak. Though occasionally, he's begun Twitter too.
Yeah, that's where the book also touches on NASA's role. So NASA was stuck in the middle. They had the SLS rocket in development, more of a traditional approach than what SpaceX was pushing, but also needed commercial partners like SpaceX to keep the ISS supplied.
Absolutely. And you see NASA conduct a pivot. They give SpaceX cargo missions, then crew missions to the ISS because it was cheaper and effective. Meanwhile, SLS moves slower.
So it's not just technology that Musk disrupted. It's also the politics and economics of space. The Air Force, NASA, the entire global launch market got an electric shock.
Yeah, and there's other competitors in the field, too. Let's not forget Jeff Bezos over at Blue Origin, his company that's working to seek to get to the stars. So Reentry points out how these guys had some rivalry, both wanted to land rockets. Bezos had the quiet approach, but once SpaceX had those drone ships landing, the race really was on.
For sure, and absolutely. It's a new multi-front war in space. Multi-domain, if you will. Commercial, military, government. Everyone wants a piece of that final frontier. At the center, though, SpaceX currently still has the momentum.
So with that, let's talk about the second space age. That reentry references basically the environment we're in right now with big ambitions for the moon, Mars, and beyond.
Oh, absolutely. And we're calling this the second space age because it's not just about NASA versus the Soviet Union racing to the moon or racing to space in general. It's private companies, it's multiple nations, and it's a serious talk about colonizing other worlds.
Yeah, so China has big plans of its own space station, really, but maybe even a lunar base. India just landed a rover on the moon's south pole. Meanwhile, you know, NASA's Artemis program is trying to get humans back on the lunar surface, and guess who's building the lunar lander? Yeah, SpaceX with Starship.
That's right. The ultimate boss fight is basically NASA, SpaceX, and others trying to outdo each other with brand new tech. And Earth's orbit is also becoming more militarized. Satellites for reconnaissance, Starlink for comms, and these satellite missiles. It's kind of a war in heaven scenario.
It is definitely reminiscent of classic war strategies. Clausewitz said, war is the continuation of politics by other means. Well, space is starting to look like an extension of Earth politics by orbital means.
Oh, I love that. You gotta coin that, Chris. So you see it with Ukraine using Starlink for battlefield comms. That's a private company impacting a real ongoing war. People freaked out when Musk threatens to limit Starlink usage in certain areas. Suddenly, a single CEO, non-military, non-governmental individual, had huge sway over a conflict.
It's wild. Musk's personal brand of diplomacy, tweeting one day, negotiating with foreign governments the next, makes him a quasi-political figure, and that in turn affects SpaceX. If the government sours on Elon's opinions, does that jeopardize new contracts?
That is a great question. But for now, the United States sees SpaceX as an essential for national security launches, plus NASA's future plans.
Yeah, and that leads to the big question. Is Elon the unstoppable force that, 100 years from now we'll look back on like we do the Wright brothers? Or is he so controversial that the public trust might wane?
Reentry basically suggests that whatever happens next, the cat is out of the bag. Reusable rockets are a big thing. Starship is being tested. The global space ecosystem is forever changed. Even if Musk left tomorrow, SpaceX's blueprint remains.
And that's a true legacy. It's a revolution, if you will. We're launching more often. We're launching for cheaper, with bigger visions. not to get too starry-eyed, no pun intended, but our generation, it's the best shot we've got at exploring Mars in our lifetime.
Yeah, and I'd love to see that happen, but let's not downplay the challenges. You know, surviving the vacuum of space, surviving radiation. Oh, and most important of all, of course, funding. The romantic view is nice, but the logical nightmares are just huge.
Sure. The audacity is what changes the world. Napoleon's armies marched further and faster because he believed they could. Musk thinks we can go to Mars, so that ambition alone drives the pace.
Exactly. And how quickly we have gone from doubting even landing a rocket to talking about a fully reusable starship that dwarfs anything NASA has ever built. You can't overstate how insane that is.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And that's why this is so relevant today, because soon you and I, probably our kids for sure, might be able to book a flight on a starship the way that you book a plane ticket, albeit probably more expensively. Or the military might rely on rapid-ready launchers for quick satellite deployment, or NASA might do monthly cargo runs to a lunar base.
All that's on the table. Meanwhile, the rest of the world hustles to catch up. We're witnessing a shift in power. Historically, controlling the seas was crucial, like the British Empire. Now controlling space might be the 21st century equivalent.
Oh, and I love that. That's a nice Mahan and Corbett reference. But you're right. Hence, re-entry is framing SpaceX as the impetus for the second space age. Because once you can land and reuse boosters, mass produce them, and innovate at the breakneck speed, you own the strategic high ground.
Wow. Chris, if that isn't pitch perfect, von Clausewitz, right? Establish general superiority, then concentrate it at the decisive point, or in this case, control over the celestial coastline.
We're basically saying, he who masters orbit, masters the future. Possibly. We'll see how it plays out, but it's thrilling to watch.
Oh, and absolutely. And you know, as much as we love this book, and to keep it within the time constraints given for our podcast, we're hitting our time marker relatively fast. So let's transition now to some closing thoughts. We've covered a lot. SpaceX scrappy origins, Elon Musk's intense leadership, reusable rockets shaking up the old guard of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and the dawn of our new space race. If you want a deep inside scoop, definitely read Reentry, SpaceX, Elon Musk, and the Reusable Rockets That Launched the Second Space Age by Eric Berger.
It's a wild ride. Eric Berger did the digging, talked to the insiders, and pulled back the curtain on how these improbable engineering feats actually went down.
Yeah, and Berger leaves us in the epilogue with a final thought that I think is worth consideration. SpaceX went from David to Goliath. It didn't take down Goliath. And in this story, there is likely not going to be an outside player to bring down Goliath. He highlights how that if SpaceX is going to be eclipsed, it's likely going to come from the inside, either through the loss of some of the great talents that keep SpaceX moving in the right direction, to include Musk, the visionary himself, or due to collapsing under the weight of Musk's larger-than-life presence.
That is a great reference, Flat. The 2020 National Space Policy explicitly states a robust, innovative, and competitive commercial space sector is the source of continued progress and sustained United States leadership in space. An iconic vindication of Musk's approach. In conjunction with this, Dr. Whitman Cobb observes that independent actors such as SpaceX have shaped how policy is determined, challenging the state-led status quo. In other words, what began as Musk's hobbyist dream of a reusable rocket paradigm shift in U.S. space strategy from skepticism to full embrace of commercial innovation. Musk's unilateral control, great for decisive innovation, risky for public accountability. Tying into Thomas Schelling's Arms and Influence, Schelling's idea of unpredictability as a strategy tool is reversed here. Musk's unpredictability is not always beneficial because stakeholders such as NASA and the Department of Defense value a reliable partner. Strategist Edward Luttwak wrote about the paradoxical logic of strategy. Here we see a paradox. Musk's very boldness that propelled SpaceX might endanger if went unchecked. I, for one, am hoping the best for SpaceX and for all of its competitors. Their success are great not just for commerce, but for the United States and all of mankind at large as it grows towards the stars. Folks, thanks for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed the comedic vibe, the historical references, and the real talk about how space isn't just up there. It affects everything down here. Politics, economy, our national security.
Stay curious, stay geeky, and keep an eye on those rocket launches, because tomorrow's big milestone might be just be a routine day in the new space era.
Yeah, and remember, folks, like Klaus Wutz might say if he were alive today, never interrupt your enemy when he's re-entering. Or was it making a mistake? Either way, it works.
Oh, flat. On that note, this is Chris signing off. Thank you so much, y'all, for joining us today.
This is Justin signing off and reminding you, if something seems impossible, maybe it's just on Elon Musk's to-do list.
Yep, and I'm flat saluting all you starry-eyed dreamers. Catch you next time on Going Orbital.